Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything to feel it coming. Do you wake up on the throne? I wonder where you are, and live with all your faults. I wanna wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all, so I don't deny
All right, on a Monday, joining us is Grant Newsham, but I didn't start the recording in time, so you're going to pick up the interview about 30 seconds into it. And I'd asked him about being a tourist in Taiwan, where he's currently working and writing and things like that. So, with apologies, Grant Newsham, Colonel, United States Marine Corps, retired, our specialist on the Pacific Rim. Here on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
I don't attract attention. I think they're used to it, or they don't care. They just look when I'm not looking. It's not a big deal. The Taiwanese are very friendly. As it is, it really doesn't attract attention.
So you walk around in an inconspicuous way in a foreign country, kind of like a member of the OSS then?
No, I'm dressed like a Lance Corporal on Liberty most of the time, because
it's
so hot.
God forbid. I hope for them, they would run you out of the country if you did that. Do you have your bright red USMC jacket on? Do you have that?
Almost, but no. It's flip flops and shorts and a T-shirt.
That's your basic American.
But the thing is, they all dress like that too.
Oh, well,
so
you know,
it's very comfortable.
The world is American, you know, and here in Southern California, you know, you have people that sneak into the country, right?
Uh-huh.
And they become a lot of different things in our economy in Southern California. A lot of the women take jobs as nannies. And so you see nannies, you know, with strollers at parks that are Hispanic. But they have yoga pants on. And they're part of the culture. You see their kids going to public school, right? And they're going to school on skateboards, right? Look, that's American, man. Our culture and our influence on TV is global, I think. So, anyway. What's the most unique thing about that culture for those of us who have never been?
I would say that if you want to see China, come to Taiwan. What you see in mainland China is something the Chinese communists have turned China into. And so I think that is actually a fair statement, that Taiwan is where you're going to see a more realistic or accurate China, at least in a historic sense. What you see in mainland China is something a lot different. One thing you do notice is that in Taipei especially, a lot of it is old. And I would say robust 70s era buildings. And one of my other theories is that you can tell a lot about a country by the sidewalks. And if the sidewalks are nice and wide and even, so that you don't have to watch for fear of bumping, tripping and falling, it tells you something. And I tried my theory out on some Malaysian friends once, and they said, you're really onto something. Because in Malaysia, you could seriously injure yourself if you're not really careful just walking down the sidewalk. And here in Taipei, I wish they were a little smoother, at least in the part where I live, because I live down sort of in the southern end near the zoo, and it's an older area near a university.
Wait. What do you mean you live there? I mean, I thought you just went there to do a little work.
Well, where I stay.
Okay, where you stay. All right, well, that's okay. I understand that.
I'm Taiwanese. I'm here forever.
Well, you are attempting to save their military, so I have great respect for that.
Well, let's see. But it's the sidewalks. I think that tells you a lot. And say where I am, so I have to pay attention when I walk down the sidewalk. They're narrow, et cetera. And that means that there's some work to do to develop or tidy up the country.
That's a city council and a local governance issue, don't you think?
Well, it is, but, you know, when countries either don't tax people enough or don't get enough money somewhere to get the sidewalks right.
Well, normally, though, the senior citizens, when they get pissed about the sidewalks, something gets done because they vote. And I'm a little bit surprised. Here's a question. Here's an email question. Hey, Mac, I just looked at a map. Taipei City, if that's what we're talking about here, why is it not on the coast? It looks like it's inland. Grant?
That's correct. I don't know why it isn't. My guess is the geography, because it's in a bowl, sort of in a natural geographic, like a, you know, a low area. And it is probably sort of an easier place or a safer place to build a city, because there is some river access to the sea.
Right.
Like, this is when they built it, that it was probably because of, let's say, the geography. Maybe sort of the way Los Angeles is where
well, you know what? That's it. Los Angeles is an interesting story because they tried to put the harbor in Santa Monica, and they had multiple piers that were destroyed when the seas got heavy. And ultimately, they said, "Look, the port, as much as we don't care for it, has to be in Long Beach." So the city of Los Angeles was built in the shape of a dumbbell, right? Los Angeles, the one head, and a quarter running down to Long Beach was part of the city of Los Angeles, and then Long Beach was also part of the city of Los Angeles. How's that for a little bit of history that you probably didn't care to hear?
I didn't know that. I was going back to when the Spanish or the Mexicans founded it. You know, that where they put it, like, I think this is where they... The last place where they're the bottom end where there's regular flow of that so-called LA River, or back then.
Yeah.
You know, like Olvera Street down there. I thought there was some connection to that in that part of.
Well, that was fresh. That was a freshwater thing, though.
Okay, but so the geography kind of I think is the reason. And if you saw the terrain, actually, there's more open space where Taipei is than by the coast, where it's a narrow coastal plain that goes up really quickly. I guess that's part of it. And plus, I think a lot of the times when you're near the coast in this part of the world, when the typhoons come, if you're right by the coast and it's a flat area, you more easily get
annihilated. You more easily get your city annihilated. All right, all that makes sense. All that makes sense. I'll accept that. But Taiwan, if you will, Formosa, all of you older adults, has never had allegiance, any connection to mainland China, yay?
That's correct.
And that surprises people to hear that, but they never have.
Well, it's a little more nuanced than that. Certainly, Taiwan as the Republic of China after 1949 was never part of the People's Republic of China. If you go back historically, there have been periods where I believe it was under some sort of control by the mainland. These were generally not for long periods of time, and I think you would even could even make a distinction that when it was under the most control, it was actually not a Chinese dynasty or Chinese ruler, what do you call it, kingdom or emperor running the show, but rather foreigners, Manchus or Mongols or people from somewhere else. So I say there's a case to be made that, yes, at some point it was under some sort of Chinese control or mainland Chinese control, but it was not all that long. It was tenuous, etc. So it needs to be explained. I should be able to explain it a little better than I can.
Yeah, you're struggling this morning. Well, first of all, what time is it?
Midnight plus.
Oh, it's early. What the hell?
It wouldn't matter if it was 9 o'clock in the morning. I'll get it next time. If next time, if you ask me, I will have it right.
All right. I can accept that.
That idea that it's never been part under mainland control isn't quite right, but it's not entirely wrong either. So it's the Chinese, mainland Chinese claim to Taiwan as having always been an integral part of China is just nonsense. But there is a period at which it was under mainland control. So that's the sort of an answer without being as specific as it needs to be, but ask me again. And I'll have it right for you. I know exactly who to ask. I've been meaning to ask them, so I would have it ready for like the cocktail party answer, but haven't got around to it yet.
All right. So if I was a tourist and I was going to Taiwan, where would you tell me to go?
I would go probably to Taipei for a couple days, and that should probably be enough. I would head down to Kaohsiung in the big city in the south to get a look at it. And the east coast.
Hold on.
Is,
wait, Kaohsiung is T-A-I-T-U-N-G?
Almost. Kao. K-A-O-S-H-I-U-N-G. Kaohsiung.
Oh, okay. It's on the south. It's on the southwest corner.
Yeah, down at the bottom. That's kind of interesting to see. That, too, once again, is a day or two. But really, the East Coast is also good. I haven't been over there yet, actually. Everyone says that's where you go. But I would say get into the countryside. And that usually means taking a tour of some sort. And that's easy to do. But the countryside's really kind of neat. And
is it? Okay, so tell me, what do you see in the countryside? In the Korean countryside, I saw a woman, right, helping her husband plow rice fields. She had the harness that would normally go on the ox, the water buffalo, around her shoulders, and she was pulling, right? She was pulling the plow. And we were riding, going to a range. I'm a second lieutenant in Korea. And I looked at that and I went, whoa, things you don't often see in the United States. So as I go into the Taiwan countryside, what would I see?
You would see, but the scenery is very nice because Taiwan has sort of high mountains and the like. So it's nice scenery, but you'll see those kind of farms, rice fields, etc. And these little old towns, a lot of them that actually still have some feel of when the Japanese were here during that colonial period. And if you get high up into the mountains, you'll find Aborigines live up there, the indigenous people.
What are they like? The mountain people are always the crazy. It's like going to Yucca Valley or anywhere in the desert. You have like the Mad Max kind of people. They're always interesting. What are they like in Taiwan?
No, these are not like that.
They're not? Shit.
No, they're the tribes that originally inhabited Taiwan, and you know they kept the Japanese at bay and everyone else at bay for a good long while until they were suppressed. But they're very interesting people, and they you still have villages up there that are tribal that are full of the indigenous people, and they're you know friendly, and they look more like Peruvians in a lot of cases than they do like Chinese people. Which isn't I suppose, isn't surprising. And just one interesting note is that the Taiwan Marines actually have, they tend to recruit maybe disproportionately or get a large number of indigenous marine recruits, and that they're very, you know, cheerful guys, that they don't mind being out in what we would call jungle, and they remind you of Gurkhas in a way when you, you know, you deal with them. They have.
And
that
what are they doing up there? Do they have any unrest up there? Are there any issues up there? Are they training up there? What's going on?
Well, no, I meant the Marine. Well, when they join the Marines, they do what the Marines do. But up in the mountains, they just live up there. It's agriculture is the big thing, like fruit growing in particular. But it's not all that easy to get up there, but that's the part of Taiwan that I think is, really should get a lot more attention, is up in the mountains. And it's actually got some very high mountains, like 10,000 feet that get, I think even do get some snow. But it's not a huge place, but if you can get out of the cities, that'd be my main recommendation. End up to where the Aborigines live.
All right. There you go. We should start doing a tourism segment with you. Yeah, you could give us advice on traveling, especially in the Pacific Rim and whatnot. Here's an email. Max, shut your yap about Taiwan, for God's sakes. Ask him about how the thing in Hong Kong will be resolved. Yeah, how long do you poke your finger in the chest of the Chinese before they let it rip on your ass, Grant?
That's a good question, because I've been following it as well, and it's pretty darn interesting to see people who have the nerve to take on the Chinese Communist Party, which is a scary enemy. And to see what they've gone into the Legislative Council building and done what they've done. I think that this is what you will find, I think, is the sort of the protesters are at some point will sort of wear themselves out. You kind of have to go away and get some sleep and that sort of thing. And you just can't go out every day. Once that happens, I think there's going to be a very severe crackdown on the leadership that's been identified, with these people being arrested. I would expect some of them to disappear, with all that means. I think there is going to be a harsh sort of secret police sort of crackdown, and the Chinese Ministry of State Security working with the local cops, who are thoroughly subverted. Nobody likes to say that, but I'm afraid it's pretty true. I think you're going to see that kind of a response. As I say, you go after the leaders and make them disappear. If you think of how the Iranians cracked down after the Green Revolution in 2009, I think that the Chinese are probably even a little better at it than the Iranians were back then. You do wonder just how long this can go, and before there is a violent response. So I would expect it to sort of run out of gas at some point, and then there will be the counterattack.
Now, Grant, everybody knows that, right? So we all know the dance of the iguana that's going to take place in front of cameras now. So, and the Hong Kong protesters have to know the Chinese don't play this game for long. And so they're attempting to extend the tentacles, right, to Hong Kong and tighten their grip. And that grip is being thrown off. She's being told to resign. Now they took over the legislature building, and now they're still going at it now. They know, so be a protester. What is the end state that they're looking for? Are they looking for to create a new Tiananmen Square moment?
No, I don't know exactly what they've got in mind. I don't know that they could quite tell you either, other than that they're sort of desperate enough and don't see a future to the point that, well, they're going to, if not go for broke, they're really going to push this more than just a weekend or two. I think it is a sign of just how frightened and desperate these people are, and a lot of them do seem to be younger people, and they, I'm not sure they could tell you exactly how it's going to play out, but if they don't do something, I see them, they can see themselves, I think, being slowly strangled, losing the freedoms they've got, and the opportunities that come with Hong Kong being a unique sort of place. It's an interesting thing, this notion of human freedom. People, when they sense it and want to keep it, they tend to act in ways that are not perhaps, what do you call it, logical, in the sense that you're going against a very powerful force. But people will stick their necks out and even their lives to stay free. Yeah. And that's something amazing. I think the communist regimes don't always realize, and when they do, it scares the daylights out of them. I think the mainland China, or the PRC leadership, I don't think they know what to do right now. They are, I'm sure, fumbling with a response. And so I'd be surprised if they had decided what to do and are kind of waiting to see what the protesters do. So this is something that I'd like. It's almost historic in a way. It's right. A comparison you might make. It's a loose one. If you look at events in Eastern Europe for in the last half of the 20th century, you have the East German workers uprising in 62 or whenever that was, the right. early 50s.
Right.
Then you had the Hungarian uprising. You had the Czech Spring in the Prague Spring in 68. And then you had the solidarity in the late 70s, 1980, and then the protests in East Germany that eventually brought down the Iron Curtain. And one without the other probably wouldn't have happened. And that's what Lech Walesa, the head of Solidarity, said when he gave a speech on the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, that one without the other wouldn't have happened. And taken in isolation, one could say, well, the Hong Kong protests don't matter much. But, maybe, who knows, that they're just one of the dominoes, with Tiananmen Square being the first one, and then something like Hong Kong being another one, and Taiwan itself being one, switching from military dictatorship to democracy, that we don't quite recognize it until some time has passed. And it would be nice to see, I think, America giving more moral and verbal support to what's going on. And that's been a big disappointment.
Well, but again, Grant, as you said, we've spent so much of our time bent over, or on our knees, not standing upright to the Chinese. To me, I would hope that in this dialogue, the fantasy of you can't go in the Strait of Taiwan. I mean, hell, the Canadians and the French are sailing through that son of a bitch. So I think that thing's done. And the next thing is, hey, look, you don't own Taiwan. And we need to come to grips with it. There are millions and millions of people. How many million people are on that island?
23-ish, which is bigger than most vast majority of countries in the UN by a lot. So what I'm getting at is that, still there?
I am.
Okay.
I'm something I don't do often. I'm listening with rapt attention.
Yeah, that threw me off. But the, what I'm getting at is that the geography of Hong Kong and also the legal status is such that you've got very limited possibilities. But you can always talk, and the significance, remember, of Ronald Reagan saying, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall."
Right.
And those sorts of things are powerful. And we just the United States government seems incapable of speaking up on behalf of freedom and its own interests. And I wish they would. So that's, is something that I do harp on. And I think it would be well advised that we start doing that and keep doing it and doing it properly. With Taiwan, as you note, that's a different story, and the opportunities for giving that direct support in a number of ways are a bit obvious, and we you kind of wonder when we're really going to start doing it.
Well, you know, again, but I mean, we've taken baby steps, right? I mean, so let's talk about the weekend, Trump at the G20. You know, the big event was his meeting with President Xi. You know, what would come out of it? Would there be a major trade announcement? And you've educated us, and I think we've all kind of come to look at, you know, the Chinese on the subject of forced technology transfers and intellectual property. That is the way their economy is engineered. That's part of the infrastructure. So how do they change that? So I don't think any of us were looking for a breakthrough along those lines. And if you can't get a breakthrough on those lines, how do you get an agreement based on the American position? Would Trump cave in and make concessions knowing that he needs to have a decent trade relationship with China in order to get reelected? It would certainly help his cause. And where would that go? So with all that said, your thoughts on the outcome of the weekend?
I wasn't all that pleased, you know, but keep in mind that I'm an observer. You know,
right.
It's not as if the orange helmsman, it's not as if Mr. Trump is calling me up asking, telling me what he's doing and what he's thinking. So I'm just an observer, but I was disappointed, actually. And here's my take on it is that particularly on the trade issue, which is the big thing going on, that it looks as if the U.S. side did what China demanded it do, which is stop being so mean to Huawei, the Chinese telecom company against which sanctions have been applied to some extent. And also don't put any more tariffs on Chinese goods. Now, the U.S. side will say, well, we still have the upper hand. You know, we've got them over a barrel. And, you know, that may be true, that, you know, the existing tariffs and the sanctions on Huawei, some of which apparently will not be relaxed, you know, we still have those, but it looks as if America kowtowed, America backed down.
Okay, now, so the question is that we gave it room. Is that a bad thing? I saw Larry Kudlow interviewed, and he said, hey, look, anything, there's certain Huawei products that we're going to allow in that are generic, blah, blah, blah. Anything that deals with 5G infrastructure or any of that, the tariffs applied to, and essentially the embargo on those still stands. And so Kudlow got his X-Acto knife out, and he said, let me take you through the footnotes of this. He says, what we're trying to do is we're trying to revive the talks, and we're taking a step back, and as are the Chinese, because they've agreed to buy farm products. And so we're both taking a step back and a breath of fresh air. You don't sound as impressed with that.
Not really. I think if you have to explain it like that, you're probably lost.
Yeah.
Not you. The administrator, Larry Kudlow, has to explain. And I like him, but he's not really a China guy. And if they were interviewing Peter Navarro or even Lighthizer, the USTR guy, either of those two, if they were interviewed and they were optimistic about what had been done, I'd be more comfortable. So I don't, as I say, if you just from a certain altitude, it looks like America acquiesced. But I would suggest that if it is being claimed that because China is buying our farm products, that is a victory. I have some real doubts about that.
No, what do you, I think I should have had the audio ready and allowed you to comment on it. But what he essentially said was, this is a step back. No major position changed. A few minor modifications as we go back to the negotiating table to allow some of the steam to escape from inside the balloon. That's, if I could paraphrase, you know, his 5-minute discussion on, I think it was on Face Nation or one of those, CBS one.
Face Nation. I would suggest that in dealing with the Chinese Communist Party, you do not want the steam to leave the room.
Right, I agree with you.
Keep the pressure on and then even add to it. This is backing off a bit. Thinking you're going to go back and have these nice discussions with both sides committed to sort of an agreement where everyone agrees to give up something and then to behave according to the laws of the civilized world, it's never going to happen. And I don't know how many times a U.S. administration has to will think that's going to happen and will do what they're doing. You keep the pressure on, and I think Nathan Bedford Forrest said you put the skier in them.
Oh, be careful. Be careful when you quote the originator of the Ku Klux Klan.
He was, but there were some other aspects about it. That also needs to be put in context.
True. Now, just to, because, you know what, I am a bit of a Nathan Bedford Forrest fan, not his later years when he was the Grand Wizard, but I'll tell you what, if for those of you who are out there who study warfare, if you ever want to study somebody who understood speed, decisiveness, put it in one cocktail, and destroy units that were much larger than him, read Nathan Bedford Forrest. It is an unbelievable story of his operations in Tennessee, Mississippi, and amazing. The phrase that you'll hear often, firstus with the mostus, that come from him. And, he was quite an interesting character.
Didn't even do distance learning command and staff.
He did not. No, I mean, he was a plantation owner, a cotton guy, and a slaveholder, and a slave trader.
Trader, actually.
Yeah. and you.
But you know what I'm getting at is that, you know, he had that magic when it came to fighting Yankees.
Oh, my God.
And
the only, if I could just throw this little piece of trivia that I've stored for so long. I don't know any other general officer in either army that killed people, right? Forrest is credited in hand-to-hand combat with killing 18 Union soldiers.
Well, he shot one of his own guys who, one of his own officers who he got in an argument with. And I've always said that, I've used the expression during some Marine Corps staff meetings when somebody is giving a PowerPoint brief, they should be glad Nathan Bedford Forrest wasn't there.
Well, you know, one thing about him that was interesting, they said when he got agitated, unlike most people that lose their shit, Forrest got sharper. And so in a fight, when he got more animated, they said he did not lose any of that. So he's an interesting read, but you have to be careful when you exalt him that you do so with all the footnotes because, you know, the post-Civil War South is a very interesting dynamic place in which, you know, the Union now lays upon Southern culture the solution of how this is going to happen. And it runs, much of it runs completely against their culture. And you have guys like Forrest who start, what arguably now would be called a terrorist organization, or at least what they looked at it as they were preserving their culture. And they ran people out of town. They scared them. They intimidated, and then they killed. They killed some. And so,
it was a mafia, a violent one. But Forrest's involvement in it is also very interesting as well. When you look into it. But anyway, this is what comes of a liberal arts education. You can hear all.
You know what? I love that about my show, though. It's a liberal arts discussion. So we're talking about Chinese policy, and somehow or other, we've happened into Nathan Bedford Forrest.
That's you never know. But my point was that with dealing with the Chinese and in these trade negotiations or the discussions we're having with them to try to resolve these problems, the only way to have any success is to keep the pressure on. If you get an advantage, you have got to keep it. And we have this advantage, and the idea that somehow backing off is going to create some goodwill on the other side is wrong. It will be looked at as a concession, and now they will simply demand more from us and be less willing to concede anything. Plus, I don't think they're even capable of changing in the way that we want them to do, which is follow fair, honest trade laws and legal systems and legal requirements. I fear now that what's going to happen is they're going to try to run out the clock until the next election and hope that there's a restoration of the people who were sort of run out of office or run out of their jobs when Trump, Mr. Trump was elected, and bring them back, and these will be the nuanced China hands who are all willing to concede almost anything and who got us into this mess. So I think you can almost predict how this is going to play out.
But if you or I were sitting in Beijing this morning, I mean, that would be our course of action, right? Like, we've got them to back off, and now as the election closes in on Donald Trump, you know, what we'll do is we'll play these negotiations sideways, and then when he needs us, we are going to deliver him a long-term agreement that doesn't have anything that addresses forced technology transfers, or doesn't have anything that addresses intellectual property, and we will get him to sign that, or else he will imperil the American economy and the stock market and his reelection bid, and we'll play his. I mean, to me, that's the play, right? That is the constant play, the longer game of a dictator versus a politician in the Western world that has to get reelected.
That's, I think, how it, I expect that's how it will play out. And it is, you know, you do, in fairness, one does have to consider domestic politics in the U.S. And there is some benefit to the president if, you know, the people think that some sort of deal is going to be reached, if some tension has been diffused. And you've seen how the markets or and all of these businesses and business groups that are whinging about not being able to sell or make his money from China.
Right.
You've seen how they've responded positively to what was done at the G20.
Right.
And that, you know, is once again, if you're trying to get reelected, that's, you know, I understand the pressure and the need to consider that. And, you know, so it's easy for me to criticize, but, you know, there's a president has to think about some more things. I would have done things differently, but I get it. And, you know, there is the, you know, when the mob or the herd thinks that, oh, say everything's going to get better, you know, the stock market goes up and, you know, confidence goes up and everything looks like it's going better. And once again, that helps your reelection prospects, and everything does depend on getting reelected. But that said, I'd have probably played a little harder game with the Chinese, and I certainly would have sooner. You know, I would have gone after Huawei much sooner, and also we've talked about before a company, ZTE, a smaller telecom company that the Americans could have put out of business a year and a half ago, and they neglected to do that, thinking, for whatever reason, thinking the Chinese would appreciate the favor, and I think that was a mistake. Timing does matter. The closer you get to an election, the more limited room you have. And when you get an opportunity, you've got to take it. And we squandered a number of good ones. So to see us do this at the G20 was kind of disappointing, because it did look like we had bowed to Chinese demands. And while Larry Kudlow can explain why we didn't, I have a feeling that if they interviewed, once again, Peter Navarro and Mr. Lighthizer, that they might see things a little differently. I don't think they would say it, but I have a feeling they may see things differently. And there's a reason why Larry Kudlow is being interviewed and not those two guys.
Whoa, the cynic comes out. All right, let me read you, let's see, a couple emails. See the National Museum outside Taipei. Incredible Chinese art. So there you got a tourism. I'm not sure if you've been there yet, Grant, but if you have not, certainly a recommendation for you.
I've heard that, and it's everyone says that. And it is the stuff they were able to move out of China in 1949. But interestingly, the museum had actually moved all their stuff several times before that in China to get away from the Japanese. So they had some experience packing up and getting out of town quickly. But this is just the last, you know, hopefully they won't have to move again.
Interesting. All right, let's talk about the trip up to North Korea. A little bit of a surprise there. The first president of the United States that sets foot on North Korean soil. What do you make of all that? Photo op, actually, you know, reopening discussions, or is Mr. Kim just taking a book out of the Chinese and offering a bit of the same?
I think, unfortunately, I think the latter. It's hard to imagine this going too far. I think, although, unless the Americans are willing to concede something, say, I think it's been talked about, concede just a freeze. And just say, okay, North Korea, if you freeze your nuclear program, then maybe we can come up with a deal, ease up on sanctions, etc. But, you know, to me it looks like something we've seen before, but it sure is interesting to watch. And, you know, never a dull moment. I think one guy felt like, we were talking and about how it just, I assume somebody on the U.S. side knows what they're doing and has a plan for this. But it kind of, and he said, you know, and he's over in Europe, and it said it kind of reminds him of in the Tour de France when people are, the riders are going down these really steep hills and they're just going a million miles an hour. Some of them will like tap on the brakes a little bit, but some of them don't. And Trump reminds him a bit of that. Is some guy who's just going, you know, he's just going as fast as he can and seeing how it goes. But I'd like to think, though, that he does have some good advisors around him and that they have talked through this or thought through it and have some idea where they think they're going to end up. So it certainly was interesting and unprecedented. Although General President-elect Eisenhower came pretty close to North Korea before he got elected, when he visited Korea.
Close doesn't count. All right, close doesn't count. We all know that. It doesn't even really. I mean, maybe in hand grenades. Blah 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 blah.
That's true. But no, I thought it. You know, it is, to put it mildly, really interesting if it will play out any differently.
Okay.
And if we're talking about
That sounds like your reaction to both the Xi meeting, disappointment laced with the next card that gets played will tell you if that was a transition moment and now we will return to being submissive to Chinese policy. And it sounds like the same thing's being said with North Korea. Yeah, it was a nice little thing. Good to see them shaking hands. We're not shooting missiles over Japan, but we'll see what happens next. Are the North Koreans really serious about ceasing operations of the Hermit Kingdom, giving up their nuclear designs in exchange for, you know, American economic assistance? Really? Do we believe that? And I guess the next cards, I guess at some point, in both those places, will tell us a little more.
You know, one thing I was thinking about this, because Mr. Trump, he gets, castigated for shaking hands with Kim Jong-il. And I was just thinking back, to what we've seen this sort of thing before. Remember when President Obama was shaking hands with Raul Castro, a murderer.
But it's so different, Grant. We love Obama. He's a beautiful human being. He's not despicable, right? He's wonderful. So whatever he does, it's all good.
Like, you sound like Oddball in Kelly's Heroes, the beautiful human being. But my point, my point, and you have the Americans hobnobbing with the Iranians, with John Kerry.
John Kerry going over and telling them to wait him out. He's only going to be there one term, wait him out.
That's right. But, go down the list, Nixon with...
Hey, Grant, let me ask you a question about the whole Iranian thing. So I watched a whole lot of commentary about the JPOA, the P5+1, all that stuff, right? And so this is what the guy said. So he says, well, the Americans can be taken to task for pulling out. But truth be told, it's not like the Russians or the Chinese ever comply with any treaty they ever sign. And the Europeans weren't doing their part as part of the agreement either. So really, the only people, and this is the funniest part, All that's missing is a rim shot, and I should tee that up right now. The only people that were unilaterally doing the right thing were the Iranians. Now I close my eyes and I think of, you know, the Prime Minister of Israel, right, who goes on TV with all these DVDs full of Iranian data that says they're looking at ways to violate whatever agreement that gets made, blah 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 blah, and I think it's all a ruse, it's all a canard, it's all a fake, right? And I see that, and I'm curious about your thoughts about that. It's all a game of charades. Right? And so what's really doing the damage to the Iranians right now are the economic sanctions. Their oil exports are evidently down 2/3, and that is killing them, and it's destabilizing the country. So this whole made-for-TV event that we've seen is focused at European allies to provide them some relief from American economic sanctions. But I just find it, you know, just watching this whole thing, it's just hilarious. This agreement that that's never been ratified by the Senate, because we don't ratify agreements, but so it has no force other than this is the intention of a sitting president, and that's what force it has in terms of American, you know, American public, I won't say policy, but American, you know, foreign policy. And nobody else is doing their part either, but it's a big deal. I find it very interesting how we do these things.
I was not a big believer in the Iran agreement either. It's one of these things that it's almost inexplicable that an American administration would do that. But then again, maybe it isn't. We get all sorts of administrations. But I think it was a bad deal. It was really kind of stupid. And as you said, if it was so good, why not do it as a treaty? So much of it was done as a backroom deal in the shadows, hoping nobody found out about it, that, you know, that suggests that you're kind of doing something you shouldn't be doing. It's the sort of thing almost leaves one speechless. Because some aspects of it just kind of seem stupid, unless I've never heard the explanation that to me made any sense. So we'll see where this goes. And also there is a notion that, well, these Iranians, you know, all they can expect is to live under that kind of regime. And once again, go back to 2009, to when they had the mass protests in Tehran after the stolen election. And the United States government said nothing, not a word. And the Iranian regime went back, they caught their breath, and they went after the protesters, the leaders, arrested a bunch of them, killed them, intimidated the rest, and put it all to bed for a while. But that'll come back. But that was an embarrassing moment for America. And that was it was the Obama administration. And the idea was that, well, if we show some restraint, if we don't say anything, the mullahs will appreciate it so much that we'll be able to establish a good relationship. How wrong can you be? But you'll get this kind of naivety or whatever stupidity in a lot of administrations. And I think it doesn't matter if they're Republican or Democrat. Boy, this was a textbook example.
Well, you know, again, the lesson of World War II is peace through strength. Why we have such large standing armies is we fought, you know, in a war that consumed the world, and 3% of the world's population died. Between 75 and 85 million people died for the lack of the Allies enforcing the Versailles Treaty in the mid-30s. Had they done that, right, that war probably doesn't happen. And 70 to 85 million people might still, you know, in some way, shape, or form, have lived their lives. So, I mean, it is peace through weakness. I don't know, like, how does that happen? And so and your admonition today, is this a transition to weaker positions, both in North Korea and with the Chinese? And obviously, you're not a fan of it.
Not really. We'll see, but timing does matter. And sometimes you get an opportunity and you've got to strike. If you don't, you lose it. You know, the other side recovers or you're not able to really go after it the way you could have for whatever reason. But when you get the chances, you've got to take advantage of them. And that's what I have some concerns about.
Hmm. I was concerned about the same thing. I thought, again, you know, the as a totalitarian state, I mean, you play the inside game because you're going to be in power for a long time. And you can constantly play on weak Western politicians who have to get deals done to stay in office and advance your cause. And it would only be the rare one and the rare time that they acted in concert. You know, for instance, it's one thing when the United States tells China that, you know, hey, the forced technology transfers, you know, the intellectual property issues, we need to settle this, okay? You need to come to the big table and be an equal member. It's one thing when the United States does that. It's another thing when the United States, Japan, South Korea, the UK, Australia, France, and Germany say that. You know?
That really is something that doesn't get enough attention, what you've just described. That is the thing that terrifies the PRC, is a unified front or something like one involving all the allies that you just mentioned, all the countries, particularly the Europeans, Canadians, Australians, Japanese, etc. You can line them up and put these restrictions on business with China and Chinese investments coming into their country and just do what we're doing to China but have everyone else doing it. That would probably be about 10 times as effective as what we're doing. And that's where I would not – I think it's unfortunate this administration has sometimes has picked some fights with some people, some of our allies and friends – over things that don't really matter much. And I would be inclined to really bend over backwards to get the Europeans on our side, and in particular, because that is, as I say, be 10 times more effective if we could do that.
Well, and again, we see it happening in the South China Sea, right? I mean, so it's different when it's the United States, you know, sparring with the Chinese, right? Well, now you have the Canadians rolling through the Taiwan Straits. You've had the French roll through there. The Brits have rolled through there. That's a whole different context, you know. And so what does China say to all that? There's nothing they can say because they know they're playing the emperor's new clothes. And so to me, at some point, we have to look around and say, okay, we're all going to go to them together. That way they can't pinch off any one of us and get us unelected, okay? So we'll stand together. Right. And, you know, Trump's going to be the first to be reelected. But Macron, you're after him. And, you know, May, you can be voted out any time. But we're all going to hang together or surely we will hang separately. Wait, I've heard that before. So, I mean, so it's that kind of stance and say, look, we need to bring them to the table of big nations and not allow them to blackmail any one of us, because if they blackmail any one of us, we will all take these actions. Holy shit, Grant, that's. I should write a paper on that, don't you think?
You should. I'll be glad to grade it for you. I would note, you know, we can't really separate the military or the defense from the economic. And the Europeans try to do that too often, the British in particular. So sending, like, one of their six ships through the South China Sea is one thing, but closing off the British market to Chinese investment is another. And that is the thing that really scares the Chinese. So it is necessary to, say, link the two. Otherwise, one ship, Chinese can watch it come and go and then close up and keep their control of the area. But when you close off the market economically, that is what really threatens to strangle the Chinese Communist Party. Because as we mentioned before, without foreign exchange, without the ability to earn foreign currency, all they're doing is sitting on all of this Confederate money. Right. And that doesn't do them much good. So.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
We've been talking about the Confederacy more than I have.
You wrote a piece about the Washington senators. Tell us. tell us about that. How about my Yankees? They went to London and they drugged the Red Sox all through the streets of merry old London.
I don't know if I like. The Boston people have become insufferable, so I'm not a big fan of the New Yorkers either. But in this case, I'm glad the Bostonians got whacked. I wrote a piece about. This is very different than the other 150 I've written in the last few years. It's like the only funny one, and it's about how being a Washington Senators fan as a child shaped my character, and it made me a loser. Kind of, so I'm very happy loser.
First of all, why would you say that and steal that line from me? There's a meter to this. So when you say that, you know I'm going to say, what do you mean that you're a perennial loser?
I'm very comfortable. I have a certain equanimity when faced with life's occasional setbacks that New York Yankees fans don't have. And I mentioned in the piece that I actually ran my theory by a Marine general.
Oh.
It was actually General Blackman. I don't know if you knew him. He was the CG3 Primef.
I've had him on the program.
Oh, okay. Well, he was a Yankees fan. And I told him, that it seemed to me that because the Senators fans kind of didn't mind losing at life so much, but Yankees fans, if they lost at all, they thought they were being cheated, and et cetera, at anything. And he says, yeah, that was like his answer was, yeah. So my theory was actually, I think it is correct, but I pointed out this out in a funny way, and I go beyond being a Senators fan. If you're a Washington sports fan, it doesn't help you much. You do kind of get, if you lose, so if Bryce Harper's in Philadelphia, well, that's okay. If the Capitals flame out in the first round of the playoffs, well, okay. No big deal. I'm happy with that. I don't think you get that reaction in Boston or New York.
All right, so give us the gist of the article about the Senators.
I think I just did.
Okay. But
because I've been a fan of theirs, it has shaped my character somewhat, so I'm actually more comfortable with losing in life. But not that you lose all the time, but if you win like a third at the time, that's okay.
Whoa, do you think that actually, I mean, that's an interesting theory. That if you come from, I'll give you an example of it. I watched an interview, I'm not a big NBA fan, but I watched a little bit of one of the games, and I saw, who's the guy who played for Toronto, who was so good, who's now a free agent?
Kawhi Leonard.
What's that?
Leonard? Or?
Yeah, Kawhi Leonard. And I'll tell you what, I was absolutely impressed with his demeanor, his intensity, right? He's no frills business from start to finish. And the head coach was talking after the series ended. He said, they swept them or they had split in Toronto, and they were going to Golden State, and he got the team together, and he said, okay, all right, look, we need to get one of the two games there. And Kawhi Leonard stood up and said, hey, screw that, we're going to beat them twice. And so to me, it's very interesting because, I think if you're a Senators fan or you grew up, I don't want to say in a loser culture, but I don't know how to articulate it right. But you would say, yeah, that's a reasonable goal. But somebody who drives the bus, George Steinbrenner, doesn't see the world like that. And maybe it comes from who you root for as a kid. That as a Yankee fan, and you're looking at your 28th, right, World Series championship, right, that's a little bit different. That culture is a little Yogi Berra's culture, Frankie Corsetti's culture, right, where they have, where's your World Series ring? Which one? I've got 13 of them. That's a little bit different than somebody else. Interesting.
Okay, well, you're adding to my inferiority complex. The story was written, lightheartedly. But now I see there was actually more truth to it than
well,
I thought.
No, it's interesting, those social things, right? Those social things that we grow up with where, you know, you're just hoping maybe we can get there. And as opposed to somebody who's been a part of something that's been more dominant that says, no, you know, we're not here to participate. We're here to win it. And, you know, marine culture is a little bit of that. It's this over the top, you know, it's not a question if we're going to win. It's only a question of how many of us will come home. Because there's no question about us winning. We don't lose. Just ask us.
I'm surprised I passed the entrance exam.
Well, now I'm questioning it now. You obviously faked your way into the organization. But, no, and that's what I tell people. The difference in the Marine Corps are the people that show up and join. They reject service with a smart service. They reject service with a see-the-world service. And they reject the more reasonable of the two ground combat options. And they take the least reasonable, as it's portrayed to them when we don't know anything, the most difficult route. That is what makes us different. When you have a corporation of people, and if you want to see Marines do something, just tell them they can't do that. Yeah, you can't do that. What do you mean? Oh, no, you can't do that. Nobody's ever done that. And then, like, cast it in stone and set your watch. Come hell or high water, right? It's happening.
That is, you know, I think that is true. You know, that distinguishes the organization. Is that there's simply no question that you're going to win. And it's a very interesting dynamic. Maybe it's, and particularly if you were a Senators fan. It's like around the complete opposite. So but the point is well taken. So it's a good article, actually. It's the only funny one I've ever written. I've written plenty with lots of sarcasm, and cynicism, and laconic wisecracking, but not this. This is the one that was actually written for fun.
Well, we like that. You know, there's nothing wrong with making it fun. Do you know that?
Well, I try, but there's a, you know, the best I can do is wisecracks.
All right. So, how much longer in Taiwan, and what are you going to write about next?
What is it? I'm writing about the restoration, which what happens if Mr. Trump loses, and the people who got us into the mess with China take over again. So that's what I'm trying to beat into shape right now. And referring to it as the restoration. I'll be here for a while longer in Taiwan.
Wow.
I'm not sure exactly.
Will you celebrate the 4th of July in Taiwan?
Yeah, I'll be here on the 4th of July.
I'll
do something. Yeah. But, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. I'll think of something.
Oh, I'm sure there'll be. You can find somebody. Email. Hey, Mac, if Grant were to recommend a book to read to get smart on China, and then a second one relative to Pacific Rim issues, what would you recommend? Newsham?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. The China book, there's a couple that, one by a guy named John Pomfret, Pomfret, who is used to be a Washington Post reporter in China, covered Tiananmen Square. He's a sensible guy, and he wrote a good book a few years ago. I forget the name, but John Pomfret, Pomfret, he wrote a good one. Another one by a fellow named Richard McGregor, M.C. Gregor, who's Australian. He was another reporter in China for a long time. I think he wrote a book called The Party, which is very good. And they're both of these guys write in ways that you like to read. Now, those would be a couple good ones I'd start with on the China. For the region, actually, what I would read is Grant Newsham's What a Marine Officer Needs to Know.
No.
I wrote it up, actually, a few years ago when I was ending my time with the Marines, and wrote out in my style really what I think a Marine needs to know to get oriented on Asia Pacific. I haven't published it, and it needs to be brought up to date a little bit, but if anyone's interested, send me an email address, and I'll be glad to send a copy. So that's what comes immediately to mind. I'm trying to think of a good regional summary, and I'll try to find, but besides this one, I'll try to find one, and next time we talk, I'll let you know what that is.
I'm looking at John Pomfret. Is that how you say it? Pomfret? Pomfret?
Pomfret, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Pomfret, an American journalist and writer born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. After years with the AP, he was sent to China as a foreign correspondent, written a book entitled Chinese Lessons, Five Classmates and the Story of the New China. That one?
I think there's another one that's new, more recent than
The
that.
Beautiful Country and the Middle Kingdom,
the
America
one.
And
yeah,
China.
That's the one. Yeah.
1776 to the present. Okay, I'm going to read that.
Yeah, he's good. And Richard McGregor is also very good in the internal workings of stuff. And I don't get a cut of their books.
All right. Well, Grant, first of all, have a great 4th of July. And like you, I'm keenly paying attention to the next group of indicators about American policy, and we will see whether this was a brief respite to restart talks with the same object in mind, or if this is the beginning of the modification and America getting off from standing straight up to bending over and being allowed, and China being allowed to bend us to their will. So I am very much curious too, and as all Americans ought to be, and concerned, and appreciate once again your humor, your knowledge, and making us smart about the subtleties of these negotiations. So thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Glad to talk. Thanks a lot.
All right. Always a pleasure, Grant. Thank you.
Right, sir. Okay. Bye-bye.
There you have it. That is the one and only Grant Newsham here on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. That'll do it. If you're just tuning in, don't touch that dial. You're going to get to hear about my weekend, which was very cool. My trip to Lake Tahoe. Yeah, for the wedding of my godson, Mike McGarry. Yep. And just what a beautiful country we have. And how fun it is to get out and drive it and meet the people along and whatnot. So you'll get to hear about that. We'll check news headlines. And then if you're just tuning in, you'll get to hear Grant Newsham again. Yeah, Grant Newsham. So Grant joined us today and in Taipei, right, one of the cities in Taiwan, working. And Grant underwhelmed and a bit nervous about the steps that the Trump administration took over the weekend at the G20. So he is paying very, very close attention to that. So you'll get to hear his comments as well. So, as we get going on this short week for most people, Alex Hollings is going to join us. Right? Alex Hollings will join us tomorrow. And we'll talk to Alex about whatever we talk about. Gear would be equipment. But Alex, he likes to talk international policy, so we'll get his thoughts on a number of things. And then we'll do a little bit of Kenny and Lynch and the Chef on Wednesday. Best of edition on Thursday. And I don't think I'm doing a show on Friday. Like, why would I? I mean, honestly, you're not going to work, so why am I? So if you want me to do a show on Friday, you're going to have to email me and say, hey, I'm going to be working, so why don't you? And I would consider it. But since not many of you are going to send that email, I'm probably not going to do it. That'll do it. On a Monday. Believe it or not, new listener from Amarillo, Texas. Yeah, how about that? A cowgirl, of all things. Didn't know they still existed. Anyway, welcome to All Marine Radio. Have a great day on a Monday. All Marine Radio is over and out.